I'm Catherine Welch, in for Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. There comes a time for many families when they need to sit down with a loved one and talk about the possibility of the onset of Alzheimer's. How do you know it's time to have that conversation, and where do you begin? That's just the start of the journey that Nancy Squillisotti helps families face as Executive Director of the Alzheimer's and Dementia Resource Center in Orlando. So, Nancy, I want to start off with a quote from the Irish poet David White, who says profound things constantly. And when I came across this quote, it made me think of my own mother with dementia. And so here it is, and we'll discuss.
Okay.
The only choice we have as we mature is how we inhabit our vulnerability, how we become larger and more courageous and more compassionate through our intimacy with disappearance. I think of that as a caregiver or a family member who watches their loved one disappear.
Right.
But then I also think of it with the patient themselves, because dementia and Alzheimer's, you lose your eyesight and your taste and your world shrinks and mm-hmm. who you are shrinks.
Right. Right. Yes, it's a very interesting quote. And it's true that I think sometimes the things that we worry about most with, especially with those that have been diagnosed with these groups of diseases, is more the emotional part of this effect on them than the physical part. Because I think the emotional part is the one piece that we can choose to be courageous, to give it our best, and to stay in the world rather than pull ourselves out of it. And it makes for such a better quality of life for the patient themselves. You know, the caregivers as well. I think as caregivers, we tend to want to protect our loved ones. And sometimes that ends up in being overprotection. And one of the things we like to encourage the caregivers to do is let your loved one continue to do the things that they can do and encourage the things that they can do and see if we can find some more things, perhaps, that they didn't know they could do. There's a choir, for example, and people who have never sung a choir, their caregivers take them and they think, I can't do this. I don't know how to sing. And then they get there and they just have the best time.
So let me get this straight. The choir is made up of people who are mm-hmm. suffering from Alzheimer's and dementia.
That is correct. It's through another local nonprofit, a wonderful nonprofit here in town called Central Florida Community Arts. They have all kinds of programs, but this is one of them. And it's actually a choir for the caregivers and their loved ones. And it's they practice every week. Anybody can go and watch them practice. It's at a church up in Longwood. And it would change your mind, I think, about this disease to a good extent, to watch folks come into the practice, especially if they've never been there and they're kind of head down and shuffling and not real comfortable. And by the end of the day, they're singing their little hearts out, happy and interacting with other people. And it makes a huge difference in how they feel about themselves.
And what have you heard from the caregivers? Does it qualitatively have some kind of a lingering effect if they're doing the singing on a regular basis?
It really does. And even research statistically will show that. We have a program called Music and Memory where we provide folks with a iPod shuffle, and then we download music specific to that individual that they love, not groups of music that they probably would love, but music that they would love. And we find that not only does cognition improve while they're listening, but for a period of time afterwards. If the listeners ever want to see something that is really impressive, they can Google Alive Inside. It's a video related to this Music and Memory program. It features a gentleman who, in the opening scenes, is literally head on the chest, eyes closed, total lack of interaction. And towards the end, he's just singing and singing. And what impressed me the most was at one point he got the lyrics wrong and he realized it and he corrected himself. Even after the music stops, the interaction continues for a period of time, which is just, to me, pretty miraculous.
Nancy, what other role do the arts play in terms of just improving the brain activity of those suffering from Alzheimer's and dementia?
The arts and other kinds of alternative therapies are the things that we're leaning on more now than ever. The Orlando Museum of Art has a program called Arts the Spark. It's really wonderful that the patient and their caregivers will go to. It's a free program. It's on a Saturday morning when the museum is closed, so it's a very protected environment for the families. And we find that folks just love that program and come back again and again and again. By and large, what we find with the arts is that it tends to instill confidence more than anything in the patients, and the confidence tends to linger, which is really helpful.
So, Nancy Squillisotti,
yes,
you are Executive Director of the Alzheimer's and Dementia Resource Center here in Orlando. Let's start very basically. What mm-hmm. is the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia?
I teach classes a lot about this, and one of the things I tell folks is I'll give you the definition and then you can ignore it because nobody's paying attention to it anymore. Basically, dementia is not a disease. It is a description of symptoms. Alzheimer's itself is a disease, is a form of dementia. So dementia is the umbrella term, which includes, you know, cognitive difficulties, difficulties with executive tasks, memory, that kind of thing. And underneath that umbrella would be vascular disease, Alzheimer's disease, Lewy body, frontotemporal. However, we find that even the medical community is now using dementia as a description of a disease. So we'll have folks say, well, he just has a little bit of dementia.
And let's talk about the symptoms for Alzheimer's and dementia. What are some of the earliest signs that family should look out for?
Financial concerns tend to be one. Having trouble writing checks, paying bills, perhaps answering the phone and people asking for money and giving money away. It's a big concern for families.
And why is that? Is it because they lose their ability to be skeptical mm-hmm. and perhaps cynical, whereas
yes.
before they sort of understood some of the subtle signs that, oh, this might
this
be a scammer.
This doesn't sound right, yeah.
And they completely lose that.
Yeah, they do. The filters, a lot of those filters are gone. And, you know, these folks that call and, you know, have something, have an idea, they call, you know, anyone, really. They tend to target the elderly, for starters. If you answer the phone, they will continue to call you. And they're really good at what they do at convincing you that perhaps somebody has been kidnapped and they need to send money. Or my mom got a call late at night from someone who said, your Social Security check is not going to be coming this month. It was 10:30 at night. So financial issues tend to be a problem, you know, getting lost, having perhaps problems with executive function, like even cooking, which follows a series of steps, sometimes can start to get difficult, and folks will mention that seems to be a problem. So, but everybody's really different, in all honesty, Catherine.
And it sounds like, ooh, that's a delicate first conversation to have. How should families approach this? Do you approach the loved one that you see these signs in, or do you go to the medical community first?
I think in all fairness to our loved ones, we need to continue to treat them as adults. And that sometimes is an issue with caregivers because they want to do things for their loved ones and they take away so much of the autonomy of their loved one. But it's best to approach it head on and say, you know, I'm a little concerned that I see perhaps some issues. What's most significant, Catherine, is not that we're going to have you evaluated because we need to see that this is Alzheimer's, but there are so many health issues, health conditions that mimic Alzheimer's that are fixable.
For example?
And you would really want to make sure that those are looked at so we can fix them. Very simply, for elders, a urinary tract infection in an elder, it's amazing how their behavior suddenly will change. They may not even realize it. And with urinary tract infections, you know, generally when they affect younger people, you tend to get symptoms. Older people don't get symptoms. They don't know that they have it. And it's very common in older folks for a number of reasons. So urinary tract infections, any kind of an infection, vitamin deficiencies, especially B vitamins. Real interesting. We had a young person come to us and they were concerned. And we said, if you're concerned enough, go have an evaluation. And they did. And it was B12. It was actually a combination of B12. And they were on a number of medications that they were not taking properly. So medication interactions, very common. I've had physicians say, if you're taking more than 3 or 4 medications, you're going to have drug interactions. Well, how many of our elders do we know are taking 5, 10, 12? And it's hard to take medications the right time, the right dosage every single day. It's hard. It really is. So there's a whole range of health conditions that are fixable. Even something like one of the stories I tell is of a family that was in the newspaper, and for 5 years, mom was bedridden. They finally had her evaluated because they hadn't. And she did not have dementia. She had normal pressure hydrocephalus, which was water on the brain. And she was treated with a shunt in the back of the brain, in the back of the head, and she was up and walking. And I say to folks, if that were your loved one, you would not want them in bed for 5 years. You would want to address that issue right up front and get it fixed. So it's more a question of determining what is going on so it can be treated. And if, in fact, it is Alzheimer's, better to catch it, or some form of dementia, better to catch it earlier so we can make plans, so we can do all kinds of things to improve the life of the patient and the caregiver.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Nancy Scuolosotti. She is Executive Director of the Alzheimer's and Dementia Resource Center here in Orlando. Nancy, are there identifiable stages?
It depends on who you talk to. Some doctors will say there's 5 stages. Some say there's 3 stages. I personally don't find the stages very helpful because every individual is different. So to answer that question, I'm not sure that there's anything real hard and fast, real hard and fast. What there tends to be more than anything is behaviors that will occur, some later, some earlier, that kind of thing. But as far as an actual stage, it's very hard to pinpoint that.
I hear from friends who have parents who have Alzheimer's or dementia. And what happens is if they go into the emergency room and they go to a doctor's appointment, they aren't the most dependable patient to get information from.
Right.
And yet at times doctors will quiz them as if they are a typical patient. Are you finding that the medical community doctors are starting to train up to identify a patient that has Alzheimer's or dementia, especially as we have this large baby boom population getting older? Are you finding the medical community is starting to think about that?
Well, I think here in our community, we're very lucky because we have the UCF Medical College, and they are doing wonderful things as far as bringing their residents into the 21st century and making them aware of alternative therapies, making them aware of the emotional impact of diseases, and having them be more effective and empathetic with families that have a chronic disease like this. So in some communities, it's improving. In others, it still really isn't. It's not a disease that doctors like to talk about. And time after time after time, we have people that call us and say, my doctor just diagnosed my husband or my loved one with dementia, and they told us to call you. And so we're calling you. We're not really sure why. And they haven't even been told it's a chronic disease. It's a terminal disease. And that's hard information to give them. That's hard information for them to hear.
And then if you're a doctor that doesn't deal in geriatrics, you have a patient come in from the ER and perhaps the main caregiver is doing it remotely from another state,
right, right.
There's a real lag time from the time the family can connect to the doctor and maybe
yes.
The patient gave the wrong information.
Yes, and it wouldn't be unusual. It wouldn't be unusual because it's difficult for them to be their own advocates.
Yeah. Do you feel like, you know, as I mentioned before, the aging boomer population coming up, is the medical community across the country, but especially here in Florida, mm-hmm. just having to adjust, having to have this at the top of mind as more people get older and perhaps more people come down with Alzheimer's and dementia?
Are you asking me if I think that there's been improvements?
Yeah. Is there enough of a critical mass that the medical community has to respond, it needs to move up to the top of the list of questions when they're saying, who is this patient?
I think partly the medical community does need to step up a little bit more, but really more than that, Catherine, I think our legislators are not doing what they can. Just for an example, the most recent research shows that Alzheimer's is really the 3rd leading cause of death, not the 6th leading cause of death. And yet we have the smallest amount of funding, much smaller than cancer, heart disease, anything like that. I think it's $480 million versus $6 billion for cancer. For every $100 that the government spends on care, they spend less than one penny on research. So there's an awful lot more that needs to be done to find a cure for this. If we could find a cure for this, that will reduce the number of baby boomers that we're anticipating may get this, and it would help as far as the concern we have about bankrupting the medical community, you know, bankrupting our costs as far as medicine goes.
And speaking of medicine, Nancy, what changes are you seeing in medication over the past few years? Is there anything on the horizon, or are researchers focusing on this area?
Researchers are focusing on it. There's no changes yet in what they've given patients, but there's an awful lot of research going on, even right here in our community. And some of it's amazingly promising, just amazingly promising in the third stages of treatment where they're starting to bring in patients and that kind of thing. I think one of the things they've done is been able to clear some of the plaques from the brain, which they've tried again and again and again and they were not successful. Now they've found a way to do that. It doesn't reverse the disease, but it keeps it from getting any worse, and that's great.
Nancy, let's shift to caregivers. Oftentimes, family will try to keep their loved one in the home.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes their loved one is in an assisted living facility. It's clearly a very taxing job on them to take care of a family member with Alzheimer's and dementia. What is the most important thing that caregivers can do to take care of themselves?
Reach out and get support from someone else. If they keep themselves isolated, they will deteriorate. Their loved ones will not have the kind of care that, not necessarily the kind of care, but the kind of environment that would be really helpful. But more than anything, our biggest concern, and that is our mission as an agency, always has been, is to take care of the caregiver. Statistically, 40% of caregivers will predecease their loved ones if they don't take care of themselves. And so the most important thing they can do is reach out, whether that's attending a support group. And some don't like that, but that's okay. You know, that they don't have to, but they can call us. They could call every day if they had to and say, I've got a question or I've got an issue.
So what resources are out there across Central Florida for caregivers?
Well, our agency, for example, that's our primary mission, is to provide education to the caregivers about the disease and how to care for their loved ones, because this is not anything we're taught. And supportive services. So we don't do direct services. We don't do adult daycare, for example, or we're not an assisted living facility. But we provide resource lists and information on any resource they may need. So if they say, I think my loved one might need some adult daycare, or I think there's a problem with my loved one and I don't know where to go, I don't know what to do. That's step number one. We will walk them through, what have you done so far? Okay, this is the process. And let's start you off with a list of neurologists and or assessment centers and or memory disorder clinics. In other words, in Central Florida, we have a lot of really wonderful diagnosticians here. And in addition to that, in addition to the neurologists, specialists, we have a state-funded memory disorder clinic, and we have what are called assessment centers, which are basically like the memory disorder clinic, holistic medical organizations that will bring in whatever medical specialty is needed to make sure that they cover everything when they're diagnosing this group of diseases, because it's very complicated. It takes at least a good 3 hours to evaluate someone for this. Because again, from what we talked about, because of all of the other conditions that mimic it, they have to rule out everything else first. They have to rule out vitamin deficiencies, urinary tract infections, all of those kinds of things first. And when they rule everything else out that it might possibly be, then they move to, okay, probable dementia, what do we have here?
As you see the population aging, do you see society in the workplace, the culture, services available, do you see it changing to accommodate caregivers as more and more people are being diagnosed with Alzheimer's and dementia?
I think in a lot of cases, employers, for example, are really getting better about, number one, making employee assistance programs available to their employees. Organizations even like ours can do so much to alleviate stress, to provide resources, to provide education. When folks are fully educated about the disease, they have less downtime at work, less absence at work.
Is there somebody who you saw a transformation once they decided to take care of themselves?
Oh, probably every one of them. One of the things that our agency does, we have a wellness event called the Caregiver Retreat, and we take our caregivers away, about 60 caregivers away, only once a year, for the entire weekend. It's really interesting to watch the caregivers who have to leave their loved ones behind, either with a family member or if they don't have someone to care for them, then we'll make those arrangements. And they come on a Friday afternoon and we serve them lunch, and then we put them on a wonderful, gorgeous bus and we go off to Daytona or wherever we're taking them. And they sort of come with their heads down and sort of shuffling, and they're looking at their phone and they're anxious. And then by Sunday night, they're singing on the bus and, you know, that kind of thing. We've had people that have come to the retreat who have actually recently lost loved ones. And we actually had, at our last retreat, we had two folks sort of meet other caregivers who had lost loved ones, and they had as well. And they sort of linked up together. So you see them taking life back on again when they thought that there was no life left. And that's just amazingly rewarding.
And is this what gives you hope? What gives
yes.
you hope?
A couple of things give me hope. That, does give me hope, because we do watch even the smallest things, teaching things, the smallest things make such a big difference. That, and the light goes on in their eyes and they think, oh, okay, I didn't realize that. For example, if a loved one says, they come out with their briefcase, honey, I have to go to work. Well, you know, you don't say to them, you haven't worked in 25 years. What are you talking about? You know, that's not the answer that you give them. Honey, where are you going? You're going to work. You love your work, don't you? Tell me about your work, that kind of thing. You know, you have to get into their world and talk to them in their world, not yank them back into our world, which is where they can't be anymore. Teaching folks things that make a really big impact on how they feel about their caregiving duties and how their loved ones feel gives me amazing hope. And the research gives me hope. Research gives me hope. I think there's an awful lot out there. I am hoping in 10 or 15 years, well, 10 years, that we will have something significant on the horizon as far as either stopping this disease in its tracks once it's started or preventing it. And that gives me tremendous hope.
Nancy Squillisotti, Executive Director of the Alzheimer's and Dementia Resource Center here in Orlando. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine.
You can find more information on the Alzheimer's and Dementia Resource Center online at ardccares.org. That's ardccares.org. Coming up, the zany Florida man seems to find himself in headlines across the nation. So what makes the Sunshine State ripe for weird, wild, and downright crazy news stories? Oh, Florida author and tweeter Craig Pittman weighs in. But first, political analysts Dick Batchelor and Michelle Ertel break down the congressional primary races. The primary is August 30th. It's time to start paying attention. Intersection returns after this. Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Catherine Welch. Political primaries for offices across the state are less than a month away. After newly redrawn congressional districts, each party is trying to capitalize on new territory. With new districts and a flurry of candidates, it's easy to lose track of who's running for what. We'll help you out with a look at two Democrat-heavy primary races, District 9 and District 10, as well as a congressional incumbent moving into a neighboring district, the 11th, to hold his position in the House. We start with the race for the 10th congressional district. This is the race to replace Congressman Alan Grayson, who is running for Senate, and it's quite the interesting race on the Democratic side. Darren Soto, longtime state legislator, Susanna Randolph, longtime Grayson aide, and Dina Grayson, who recently married the congressman turned Senate candidate. There's also two other candidates, Valerie Crabtree and Carmelo Garcia. And we're joined by Dick Batchelor, former state legislator and president of Dick Batchelor Management Group. Hello, Dick.
Hello.
And Michelle Ertel, president of Florida Strategic Advisors. Hello, Michelle.
Hello.
Dick, I'm going to start with you. Is there a clear front runner in this race?
Well, I would ordinarily say that Darren Soto, being an incumbent senator, would have a leg up. It's a very large Hispanic population in that district. But Susanna Randolph, who was the aide to Congressman Grayson, ran his local office, so she had a lot of outreach. She got in the race early. She signed up very large and substantial Democratic contributors. So she was out front. But now we've got this new thing where Congressman Grayson's wife is now running, and she's got name recognition. So it's going to really be in flux for a period of time. So name recognition is very important in a race like this.
But the seat was redrawn a little that carves some of that Hispanic voter constituency out, and which would presumably hurt Darren Soto.
It would hurt him a little bit, but he's raising money. But so is Susanna Randolph. Again, she got out early. She's got big Democratic contributors behind her. She's got Emily's List and a whole host of big supporters behind her. But I just don't too early to weigh the impact of Grayson's name recognition in this race.
And I want to get to that, Michelle. Here we have Susanna Randolph, who has been doing the spade work, lining up the endorsements, clearly has a machine behind her to do the door knocking, get out the vote. And then you have Dina Grayson, who has the last name, in a primary. Is it the get out the vote? Is it the get out the vote grassroots effort? Or are you depending on the voter who just sees Grayson and checks that box?
Well, I think that's what Dr. Grayson is hoping. But in a primary, it is such a low turnout, maybe 20%. So we're talking Democratic super voters that will come out in an August primary. they have to come out to want to vote for somebody or something on that ballot. So if we're looking at name recognition right now, we're going to see Grayson. And actually, in November, she was polling at 3%, and now she's polling and she's up by 20. She is just with the name recognition. ID is everything. Also, ballot order is quite a bit is important, too. Valerie Crabtree is going to be first. Dina Grayson is going to be second.
Hmm. So voters, very short attention span, don't want to go down the alphabet to the R's?
Or? Well, it's, you know, the first person on the ballot gets about a 3-point bump.
Wow.
And Valerie Crabtree, I have to give her some credit. She appears every place. I think she's been cloned. Everything I've attended, she's been there. And she's burning some leather, but she doesn't have very much money. She's only raised about $60,000, but she's trying to run on issues like term limits and all to try to divide herself from the other candidates. But it's going to take money, and name recognition is so very important when you have a low voter turnout.
And what role does the Latino vote play in this district? Does Darren Soto have it in the bag, or are they up for grabs?
I think they're up for grabs. I don't think he has it in the bag because a lot of the voters are relatively new to this community. And the question is, have they registered to vote? And voter performance is very, very important. It's not as good as it should be in the Hispanic community. So Darren's going to have to work very, very hard to get that vote out because the voter performance in the Hispanic community is not where it needs to be.
We talked about Dr. Grayson having the name recognition, but then we have Susanna Randolph, Darren Soto, even Valerie Crabtree, who have experience. Michelle, what role will experience play in this primary?
Experience does play a big role. Susanna Randolph worked very closely with Dr. Grayson's husband, Alan Grayson. She worked with him for many, many years. So she does have experience. She knows what she's doing. The newbie on the block is Dr. Grayson. Darren Soto is very experienced. He's well-liked. He's moderate. The very liberal wing of the Democratic Party is calling him out for his close alliance with the NRA. But the fact is that when he was in the state Senate, people loved working with him. He worked across the aisle. So he's got a reputation for just being a really good guy and a guy that will work with everybody. So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, that's a very good point that she makes, too. I think Michelle makes the point that in the Democratic primaries, you have the diehards, and the diehards traditionally are more liberal. They tend to be from the left. Susanna Randolph picks up those endorsements, and so she has that advantage over Darren Soto. Even though he's an incumbent state senator, he does have a record as a moderate working across the aisle, which is a good thing in the general election. But in the primary, you have Susanna go after the more liberal voters who tend to vote in high propensity in the primary.
Could we be seeing a runoff?
That would be interesting. You know, I keep looking at Susanna Randolph and her background in community organizing, and she gets an A-plus grade for community organizing. She was, I believe, the director of ACORN.
She was the director.
ACORN, which was an organizing group. That's what she does, and she's very good at it. She did it for her husband, Scott Randolph, when he ran for tax collector. So I think she's going to have a little bit of an advantage going into Election Day because she will have the get-out-the-vote down pat. She knows exactly which doors to knock on and what she needs to do to get people to the polls.
And Scott Randolph, her husband, is pointed out as a tax collector. Currently, he was a former House member, and his district happens to be subsumed in that congressional district. So it's a nice head start for her.
Little spousal right. name recognition right. going on with her as well. Let's get to two of the lesser known candidates, Valerie Crabtree and Carmelo Garcia. Dick, what do we know about them?
Valerie teaches real estate. She's a realtor herself and teaches the real estate college, if I can call it that. Again, I said that she's trying to differentiate herself by talking about term limits and more money for substance abuse and mental health counseling and those kind of things. But she's there. She's working hard. She's not able to raise the money that she needs to raise. Again, I think she's only raised about $60,000. But she's there at events. She's pounding the pavement, so to speak. So I wouldn't discount her with her being at the top of the ballot, but it's, again, she's competing against a very well financed campaigns.
Carmelo Garcia, do we know anything about her?
Very, very little. You know, she will probably take away from some of Darren Soto's Hispanic vote just by her last name, and women generally get more votes than men when there's a mixture. So she'll get some votes from him, but I don't see her coming in anywhere near the top.
Now, Michelle, let's look at the Republican side. Not as many running as on the Democratic side. We have Wayne Libnitsky and Wanda Rentis. Tell us a little bit about these candidates.
Well, let me tell you about Wayne. He's a Republican. He is a Navy guy, and he's an engineer. But I'm not sure that any of that really matters. This district, the way it is now, is very heavily Democratic. It's safety for a Democratic candidate. A Republican candidate, no matter how great they are, is going to have a very hard time anywhere in that district.
Mm. If you have, to your point, Michelle's point, 183,000 Democrats registered, 111,000 Republicans, and 142,000 no party preference. So that is a very, very strong Democratic congressional district.
So why do you run if you're a Republican?
Because you have an ego, because somebody has asked you to, because you've always wanted to do it. It's your dream, because you have delusions that maybe you can win. Somebody tells you you can win. The executive committee wants to put someone up just so that the Democrat doesn't have a free pass. I mean, there, any of those reasons.
For the same reason a Democrat is running against John Micah, essentially.
Correct.
All right. Mm-hmm. Let's move now to the 10th congressional district. In the Democratic field, we have Val Demings, Geraldine Thompson, Bob Poe, and Fatima Fahmy. Dick, for those who are new to the area, tell us a little bit about these candidates.
Well, Geraldine Thompson is a former House member, former and currently a Florida senator, and a very, very effective one. She's got a very good record, and she's very strong. She's worked the community at the grassroots for a very long time. She's worked at Valencia College as an associate professor there. She runs the Wells-Built Museum, which is an African-American historical museum downtown. So she's very well connected. Then you go to, you know, Val Demings, you know, and Val Demings, of course, former police chief of Orlando, ran against Dan Wimsher last time, came close in the race. She's loved by the DCCC, which is a Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. She's loved by Nancy Pelosi. She's had the DCCC down raising money for her out front. Unusual that the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, would weigh in the primary. They wait usually until the general, but they weighed in with Val giving her money. She's raised a lot of money, a lot of name recognition, having the police chief and run before. So she's very strong. Bob Poe, another great candidate. Bob Poe is the former chairman of the Democratic Party in the state of Florida. He's homebred. He was raised in Pine Hills. A self-made millionaire. He's already put $1.3 million of all money in, says he will match dollar for dollar anything else that comes to other races. So, you know, he's a strong candidate. And Fatima Fahmy is an attorney locally. She's putting in a lot of shoe leather in the campaign, shows up at all the events, but has not been able to raise any money. And it's going to be a very interesting race now, because you've got, out of the four candidates, you know, three very strong Democratic candidates, any of whom could win on their own. But now they're competing against each other.
And with the events in Dallas, Baton Rouge, Minnesota, this is an interesting time for Val Demings to be an African-American former police chief.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think with that issue, she has some gravitas, having been the police chief, had worked in community relations, having to bring the community together. But on the other hand, I give Senator Geraldine Thompson the same amount of credit, because she's really bring the community together every time there's been any kind of adversity in this community. She's always been on the front lines, too, so I have to give her credit, too.
Oh, she was immediately on the front lines after the Pulse shooting.
Absolutely.
Back in June. Michelle, I want to ask you this question, because this district was handedly held by Republican Dan Webster before congressional redistricting. Where do Republicans in the 10th district, where do they go?
Well, they wait until the general and they vote for Thuy Lo, who is a Vietnamese-American. Just a wonderful lady, very smart, good Republican. She's spending this this week up at the Republican National Convention. She spent the last cycle running in a primary, which, had she won the primary, she would have faced Corinne Brown. So Thuy is a very formidable candidate, but it's going to be a very difficult race again. Like the 9th, the 10th is very safely Democratic.
And Dick, with it being redistricted, there are African-American communities like Pine Hills, mm-hmm. Washington Shores, Eatonville added to the district. But what does this do to Val Demings and Geraldine Thompson, both African-American women? Do they split this vote?
Well, that is one of the questions out there, is because their Bob Post taking a little bit of heat getting in the race because it was seen as an African-American race minority majority seat. And with Geraldine Thompson vying for the same votes as Val is, do they split the vote and does Bob come in and pick up a majority? I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but there is some blowback. There is some resentment out there thinking that this district was drawn specifically for an African-American, but Bob Poe getting in it. But Bob is a very honorable man, and I'm sure he's gotten in this race for all the good reasons, so I don't question his judgment on it.
Now moving to the 11th district, for those of you playing along, incumbent Richard Nugent, he's retiring. Daniel Webster moving from the 10th district to the 11th. He's also going up against Justin Grable. Michelle, what do we know about Justin Grable?
Well, he was endorsed by Nugent. He was his chief of staff. He is very well liked. He's a homegrown guy. But up against Daniel Webster, man, that's going to be a really tough race. This is a guy who is well-loved, Democrats and Republicans alike. He is a good, decent guy, truthful, honest. You don't hear a bad word about him, except, well, I don't think John Boehner was a big fan of his because he kind of led the charge against him. And, you know, 12 folks joined along with him in that vote. Maybe he had a little foresight about what was going to happen, but he you know, Dan Webster is going to win this hands down, no sweat.
All right, you'd put money on that.
I would put money on it.
I have a couple of questions just in general. These primaries are in August, months before the general election. Is this going to drum up any voters? How are they excited about these primaries? What's your sense of these races?
No, they're not.
I don't think so. I agree.
You know, it would be really great if everyone went out and studied their candidates and put their 2 cents in on election day, but it just doesn't happen.
And that's why the name is just so very important. I have this theory that people don't pay attention until after Labor Day. You know, school's back in, the last vacation's been had, and now we got to focus on business and family and schools and politics. So I think it's a very hard to get to any substantial attention in a political race during the summer months.
Michelle Ertel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dick Batchelor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, why do the strangest things happen in our state? What makes it so ripe for weird, wild, and downright crazy news stories? O Florida author and tweeter Craig Pittman has a couple of theories and some really great stories that could only come from Florida. That's when Intersection continues. Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Catherine Welch. The new book, O Florida, looks at how Florida's crazy news stories can influence the nation. The ever-popular Florida man seems to snag headlines across the U.S., but what makes this state prime for viral news stories? Tampa Bay Times reporter and author of O Florida, Craig Pittman, pondered those questions and dissects the Sunshine State's influence on all things wacky. So, Craig, let's start with you to make sure the listeners who might be a little confused with the pro wrestler, Craig Pittman.
Pitbull Pittman.
Tell us a little about yourself. You're a Florida native.
Yes, I was born and grew up in Pensacola, and my family traces its lineage in Florida all the way back to 1850, when I suspect they came down here looking for a good deal on waterfront condos.
And when did you arrive at the Tampa Bay Times?
I started at the Times in 1989 and started covering environmental issues in 1998. I think I've almost got the hang of it. Almost.
As we're talking, you focus on the environment. South Florida beaches are being plagued with this blue-green algae, and now it's floating into the West Coast as well. What do you make of this recent toxic algae bloom, and how does it compare to what you've seen in the past?
Well, the toxic algae bloom, of course, originated in Lake Okeechobee, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has been pumping water out of the lake since January because of so many heavy rains there. We're in the middle of a hurricane season, and so they worry that if there's more rain, going in, more water going into the lake, it will, the dike will start leaking and perhaps even collapse. So they try and keep the water level low, which means they dump water eastward into the St. Lucie River and westward into the Coosahatchee River. And anything that's in the water, including this toxic blue-green algae, goes with it. And so that's why we've had this massive toxic algae bloom on the East Coast, you know, blanketing Martin County and some other counties and ruining their 4th of July holiday for tourists and businesses. And now it's starting to show up on the West Coast as well. Something similar happened in 2005, and everyone vowed they would find a solution and make sure it never happened again, and then they kind of forgot about it. So, you know, in Florida, we are sort of condemned to forever repeat these news stories, unfortunately, because it's so easy to kick the can down the road, and then new voters come in who don't know anything about what's happened in the past, and, you know, until it happens all over again, then people are like, oh, wow, oh, maybe we should fix this, and then something else will happen.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Craig Pittman, author of Oh Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country. Craig, you've written a number of books on the environment, and now your latest is Oh Florida. I have to ask, if you were born and raised in St. Louis, would you be writing Oh Missouri?
Oh, no, definitely not. Because, well, two reasons. One is, you know, certainly weird things happen everywhere. There are humans. And the thing is, more of them happen in Florida, and they tend to be weirder. Partly that's because we are the third largest state now. We have 20 million people living here. Plus, we have about 100 million tourists coming to visit every year, and everybody kind of crams into this one 35, 40-mile-wide strip around the coast and along I-4 where, you know, we're constantly banging into each other's cars, swinging machetes at each other, arguing over whose dog pooped on whose lawn. And that tends to generate an awful lot of stories, far more than you would find in any other state. If you're familiar with the somewhat snarky website FARC, Florida is the only state that has its own special tag on FARC.com for all of the weird news that we produce, and that's been the case since 2001.
I have a theory that the alligators actually tip the scale to make Florida the weirdest state.
Well, you know, and you'll see in the book, animal-related stories are a big part of why Florida's so weird. You know, we've got alligators battling pythons in the Everglades. We've got giant African land snails that were smuggled in by a religious cult and are now being tracked by snail-sniffing dogs, which I'm pretty sure Florida is the only state that has snail-sniffing dogs. We've got people who think it's okay to ride on the back of manatees because, sure, that's what you do with an endangered species, right? And so all of these things combined help to make it such a fascinating state. I mean, even in the realm of mythological creatures, we're in the lead. I always tell people, Florida is the only state with a list of government jobs includes mermaid as a job title.
Gotta love Florida. So we've tackled the weird part in the title of your book, Oh Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country. Now let's talk about that influence. How does Florida influence the rest of the country?
Well, as I tried to show in the book, that a lot of things have happened in Florida or people from Florida have influenced things that have gone on in the rest of the country. For instance, the guy who invented the computer, John Adanasoff, grew up in Polk County. His father was a phosphate mining engineer and carried a slide rule, and young John became fascinated with his father's slide rule, and that set him on the course to eventually developing the first computer. Jeff Bezos, the guy who started Amazon, grew up in Miami. His first business was started there. If it had failed, we might never have heard from him, but it succeeded. There were a lot of other examples. There was a case involving two crooked cops in Miami Beach, and they were accidentally caught on talking on their walkie-talkies by a ham radio operator who couldn't sleep one night, and he made a tape recording of their discussions. It led to their arrest and conviction. Their case was appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, not based on the facts of the case, but because there was a TV camera in the courtroom during trial, and the Supreme Court okayed it. So that's why we now have cameras in the courtrooms all over America, is because of these two crooked cops who were ripping off businesses on their beat and a ham radio operator who had insomnia.
So what's the weirdest Florida story you've ever heard?
There are quite a few, and I've actually debated this with other connoisseurs of kooky here in Florida. We usually wind up with two or three examples. One is the guy who was in a cockroach-eating contest trying to win a python from a pet store. He won the contest, but he died because he choked to death on insect parts, which I always wonder, where was that box on the medical examiner's form for a cause of death? Another one is the case of Count Carl von Tanzler, or at least that's what he called himself. He was not actually a count. He was just an x-ray technician in Key West who fell in love with one of his patients And as I report in the book, his love transcended death, by which I mean after the patient died, he dug up the body and lived with it for 9 years until the victim's sister found out and reported him to the authorities. He was put on trial for grave robbing, but was ultimately acquitted because it turned out the statute of limitations had expired. One of my favorites, and this one's really kind of too long and involved to tell on the radio and a little too risque, but it's the case of the naughty nympho, Kathy Willits, who was, shall we say, entertaining guests for pay in her bedroom while her husband, who was a sheriff's deputy, filmed everything. And ultimately, there was a big legal battle over her list of clients and all the videotapes that went to the Florida Supreme Court, and people were wearing T-shirts saying, "I'm on the list" or "I'm not on the list." I like that one because just as you think it's as weird as it can get, it got a little weirder, which to me is the hallmark of a good Florida story.
Craig Pittman, Florida is a very large state, but so is California and Texas, and yet you have stories in your book about various crimes committed in Florida, which there are crimes committed everywhere. Yet Florida gets, for example, sort of toward the end of your book, you talk about a stripper who was in her, and it's kind of embarrassing even trying to convey this story, in her underpants showing Judge the evidence.
Yes.
We have our share of Florida crime stories. Why do you think that Florida gets these stories and, say, a California or a Texas just doesn't in the same kind of frequency? Or is it that people, they see the Florida first and they've created their own pattern?
It's a little bit of both. But to me, it's even more the fact that we've got so many people here and we're active year-round because of our wonderful weather. So, you know, at times when people in other states might be cooped up inside because of a blizzard or something like that, we're out still doing crazy, kooky stuff. And also, it's, I think, because of the sort of the culture here in Florida. We're so tourist-oriented and so oriented towards, you know, live for today, grab for the gusto, you only live once attitude, that people tend to do things, risky things, without thinking too far ahead and worrying about what the consequences might be. And often those consequences are either embarrassing or very, very dire. And also, too, I think we're also very easily distracted. One of my favorite examples is that in 2012, so many people crashed their cars into post offices in Florida that the U.S. Postal Service ran public service announcements saying, "Please stop hitting our post offices."
And we have the recent news story of the woman who had her eyes closed while she was praying and
yes.
driving.
Praying and driving, yes.
Drove into a home.
Yes, yes, which it was the instance where I guess, you know, she said, "Jesus, take the wheel." And Jesus said, "No, you're driving. You do that."
So there are stories like these, and everyone across the country rolls their eyes at Florida. But wouldn't America be more boring without us?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And, I mean, this is such a fascinating state. I think it's the most fascinating state of the 50. And, you know, I always tell people, if you want to live somewhere where you that's boring, you know, move to Wyoming or someplace like that. But if you live here, you can always count on opening the newspaper every day or listening to the news every day and going, "Holy cow, you know, what are those folks doing?"
So, Craig Pittman, clearly you've had enough time to collect string to write this book. What sparked you to actually just sit down and put pen to paper?
Oh, the impending presidential race, because I knew, you know, that once again Florida was likely to become the swingingest of swing states, and people would once again be looking at us and, you know, looking at us askance and going, "What is wrong with Florida?" So I wanted to try to explain to people, well, this is what Florida's all about. Don't, you know, you just look at us maybe once every 4 years and wonder about us. But here's what's going on all the time. Here's a sort of a history of our culture and our politics and so forth that will try to help you maybe understand just what an interesting and unusual place this is.
Craig Pittman of the Tampa Bay Times and author of Oh, Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Tampa Bay Times reporter and author of Oh, Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. I'm Catherine Welch. Thanks for listening.